This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Nearly a third of Russia's Summer Olympic hopefuls, that's 118 of them, were barred from the games this year, the fallout from a state-sanctioned doping scandal. But it's not the first time a country has organized widespread doping, with or without its Olympians knowing about it. Perhaps you'll recall the world champions of doping in years past, the East Germans, who sanctioned doping for decades. Maggie Kurth Baker, senior science reporter at 538, is here with that history and other Olympic science news this week. Welcome back, Maggie.
Thanks for having me.
So there's a storied, so to speak, history of doping in the Olympics.
Yeah, so Vice Sports has this really amazing collection of stories on doping in sports out this week, including a piece by Brian Blickenstaff on the story of Gerd Bonk, an East German weightlifter who has possibly the best weightlifter name ever, and who is also credited as the guy who ingested the highest quantity of anabolic steroids in history.
Wow. So that's its own Olympic record.
It is. Yeah, yeah. In one 12-month period between 1978 and 1979, Gerd Bonk consumed 12,775 milligrams of steroids, which Der Spiegel later equated to the amount of steroids that an entire stable full of calves would have been fed.
Wow. He must have been a big guy.
Yeah, well, and also his kidneys were in failure by 1984. But his story is part of this really interesting backstory that I just didn't know about. I mean, like, I grew up knowing that the East Germans doped, but I didn't really realize that it was this coordinated state plan. Like, it actually had a name, State Plan 14.25. And it involved the organized doping of children at state-sponsored sports schools, often without their knowledge or consent. There's a story that Blickenstaff tells about an ice skater who, you know, years later, after this stuff became public knowledge, reporters contacted her and said, you know, do you want to comment on the steroids that you took when you were skating? And she said, what? What steroids?
Wow.
She had no idea.
She thought it was vitamins or something that they were giving.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that seems to have been at least somewhat common within that system. And it was also interesting because of its role in human research. You know, so this East German program became the research base for clandestine studies of how steroids contribute to increased performance. And later, after it became not secret and after the Berlin Wall fell and all of these documents came out, those same people have ended up being sort of the source for studies of negative consequences of steroid use over time. You know, we now know that 55% of the women who were doped in that program ended up with gynecological illnesses.
Wow. So they were sort of the human guinea pigs for what steroids did.
Yeah, they really were.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So this is still going on today. I noticed in the swim pool, in one of the recent races that we had, U.S. gold medalist Lily King was wagging her fingers at the Russians, the Russian swimmer,
right.
Wasn't she?
Right. Well, yeah. And it seems like the Russians have had their own systematic state-sponsored doping scandal happening right now. Mm. So it's not something that's just relegated to the history books, but the scale and coordination of the East German program seems to have been really unique.
Wow. Now, your second story is about why we might not want to cross our fingers for any new world records in the marathon this weekend. What's with that?
Yeah. So at 538, my colleague Christy Ashwanden has a sports science column that looks at why it's difficult to break records in the marathon and why Summer Olympics are almost the least likely place for that to happen. And it turns out that a big part of it is the weather. So the races, you know, when people have gone back and done studies to see what kind of conditions were prevailing at the races where people have broken marathon records, well, they found that low temperature is one of the big factors, that the average temperature for a record-breaking marathon is 43.2 degrees Fahrenheit. And this Sunday, when the women race in Rio, it's supposed to be 80 with 70% humidity.
Just twice the number that were.
Just twice the number. Yeah. So, you know, it sort of starts to make sense why it might be difficult to run at the same pace.
Well, maybe
in that kind of situation,
it seems to imply that you're in the wrong Olympics, right? Maybe you move them to the Winter Olympics, where it might be cool like that. With global warming, they're having trouble with snow. That might be the right time to run them.
Maybe it's time to change that. We'll write to the Olympic Committee.
How much time can marathoners really shave off from record times? There must be a limit to human ability, right?
You know, there is, and over at BuzzFeed, Peter Aldiss has a story about track and field more generally. And a couple of studies that he's citing there are kind of suggesting that we might be coming up against the limits of the human, you know, human physics in a lot of the track and field events. So like men's javelin, the record was set in 1996 and nobody's come close since. And one of the studies that Aldiss talks about was really suggesting that men's running events were within 3% of the limits of human biology now.
Wow. Let's talk about the last story, and it's about the technology replacing the calls of touche in fencing. I was watching that the other day. It's fascinating with all the electronic swords and touching and things.
Yeah, so you can call this electrified fencers.
Ooh, I like it.
Yeah, there you go. I was hoping that would hit. So this is a story from Atlas Obscura by Eric Schilling, and it is about how fencing is scored, which honestly I had never really thought much about. And it turns out that initially fencing was really relied on the honesty of the fencers. But back in 1896, somebody suggested a system where the fencers would wear a suit that incorporated some kind of conductive metal, and then they'd use a sword that had an electric charge in it. And when the sword met the suit, you'd complete an electric circuit and a bell would ring. And that is the basis for today's scoring system for fencing. You know, the classic foil fencing that you really think about when you think about fencing didn't adopt that system until the 1960s because they kind of had to wait for the technology to weave bits of metallic lamé into the specific parts of the suit where you get points for hitting. But it's what they use today. And so every time you watch fencers, you're watching people in these really interesting sort of analog electric suits.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Walking around swinging swords at each other.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. You see them flexing it and testing it out. They test it out on each other before they start the fencing.
Yeah.
Thank you, Maggie. Maggie Kurth-Baker is a senior science reporter at 538, based out in Minneapolis.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And you're not going to believe this next segment. Facebook has come up with a new way to alter your newsfeed, and it is a shocker. How many times have you scrolled through tons of stories with headlines like, "You won't believe this," and once you click on them, it turns out to be a disappointing top 10 list. Well, you have fallen into the clickbait trap. And Facebook has noticed that too. And they have come up with a way to tackle clickbait. And you won't believe this, it's an algorithm. Here to break down the good and bad of the strategy is Will Aremus. He's Slate's senior technology writer here in our CUNY studios in New York. Welcome back, Will.
Thanks for having me.
This is, wow, I'm not going to believe this clickbait. That's what you see all the time.
And then, of course, you totally can believe it.
So let's start out with, how does Facebook define a clickbait?
Well, you know, it's actually hard to define clickbait, and that's part of the problem here. But I think a widely accepted definition would be content that is created online whose sole purpose, or at least the chief purpose, is just to get you to click so that you can view the ads that are on the page. It's not there to enlighten you or to change your mind about something or to inform you or to even to entertain you. It's just there to get you to click. It's a trick, basically. It's a headline that sucks you in.
So what's the good thing about this?
So the good thing about this is nobody really likes that stuff. I mean, when we're talking about genuine clickbait, the examples that Facebook cited in its blog post announcing this change are the kind of stuff that basically nobody ever wants to see in their Facebook feed. You know, when she looked under the couch cushions and found this, she was astonished. And then you click on it, and it's like a piece of lint. And so if Facebook has found a new way to crack down on that kind of total junk, then that's great. I mean, you know, who's going to complain about that, really? They've in fact been trying to do this for a couple of years. earlier on, they did it by studying your behavior. So if you went to a site and then came back right away, mm-hmm. they thought, well, maybe that was clickbait. Or if you liked a story before you read it, but then you read it and came back and unliked it, they say, oh, they, you know, that story did not deliver what was promised. Now this is a new way to do it. It's using a thing called a machine learning classifier. It works a lot like a spam filter, and it actually analyzes the text of the headline itself to try to filter out more clickbait than before.
So what could be the bad thing about this?
Well, the bad thing is that there are always unintended consequences when you change an algorithm. Clickbait is, in many ways, a problem of Facebook's own making. You know, in the old days, the way you made money in the media business was through loyalty. You would get people to subscribe to your newspaper or magazine. You would get people to tune in to your network for the nightly news because they valued the content you were creating on a regular, ongoing basis. Facebook created this new media economy that's based on clicks rather than loyalty. It's, you know, you don't reach your readers on your homepage anymore or, you know, through a subscription. You reach them through Facebook. And so Facebook has created this game that people play. Well, every time it changes the rules of the game, people are just going to play it differently. So people will find new ways to write different kinds of headlines that lure you into junky content. Meanwhile, Facebook will achieve its goal in all likelihood of keeping you on Facebook. And that I think, is the real effect here.
Don't leave that page. You want to stay in Facebook.
Exactly. If the headline tells you everything, then why click at all?
Right. So Facebook is actually fighting something it created before.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if there were no Facebook, you know, there might not be clickbait, or maybe we would just find it on some other platform.
And how much actually has the news feed shaped how writers create headlines and stories?
The effect has really been profound, because if your business is to get people to come back to your site every day, week in, week out, you're going to cover the news in a certain type of way that respects their intelligence. If your business, and now this is everyone's business online in the media, if your business is to get people to click on your stories on Facebook, you need to write a totally different kind of story that is going to stoke people's curiosity rather than a story that's really going to inform them.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Will Aremus, senior technology writer at Slate, that's Slate based here in New York. After the break, we're going to ease you into the weekend with some particle physics. I know you want to talk about it. You've heard about the neutrino. What about the sterile neutrino? Yeah, we'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For you physics geeks, July 4th, 2012 is a special day, because on that day 2 years ago, 4 years ago, I should say, scientists at the LHC announced they had observed the Higgs boson. The hunt lasted nearly half a century, but the Higgs was only the tease. It filled in a big piece of the puzzle of understanding the universe, but gaping holes remain to be filled in the particle zoo. And this week, teams of particle hunters, one from the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, and the other from the Ice Cube neutrino detector in Antarctica, reported that, no, they have not found signs of any new particle. Bummer. Well, but the search continues. What exotic particles are physicists looking for, and why? James Beecham is a postdoctoral researcher at The Ohio State University. He's also part of the ATLAS team at CERN. He joins us from Geneva, Switzerland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Janet Conrad is a professor of physics at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to you, Dr. Conrad.
Hi. Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
And if you don't know a neutron from a neutrino, we'd like to hear from you. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. Dr. Beecham, we have spotted the Higgs again after that first finding, haven't we?
Indeed, we have. It's one of the biggest successes of the last round of results that we released at this big conference last week. We did rediscover the Higgs, so this is fantastic news.
So that got a lot of folks at LHC excited about possibly finding some new stuff. This little bumplet they talked about that turned out not to be a new particle.
Well, yeah. In fact, it's been a bit of a whirlwind few months because of that little bumplet. But yeah, so that got a lot of attention in the press. The Higgs discovery is somewhat distinct from that, but this little diphoton bumplet, it was a suggestive hint of new physics that we announced back in December of last year. It turned out that at the time we pointed out this was not so statistically significant. A little bumps like this come and go in our field, but the kind of suggestive thing about it was that both us in the ATLAS experiment and the CMS experiment, we kind of roughly saw the same little bumplet at about the same place. So the theory community sort of ran with that, and the news got in on the subject. And so there's a lot of this was the topic of a lot of attention. And so then we took about five times more data this this year, and it turned out that the little slightly not so suggestive bumplet turned into a nice smooth line. So that's no new physics there, but yeah, it's been a whirlwind few months.
Yeah, I'll bet. Dr. Conrad, you call yourself an anomaly hunter, and you specialize in neutrinos. But the neutrino is accounted for, right? I mean, why is the neutrino really interesting?
So the neutrino is one of the only standard model particles that has actually been behaving differently from the way that we actually predict particles should behave in the standard model. And we've already seen it behave differently. We have seen that neutrinos have mass when the standard model says that neutrinos should not have mass. So that leads you to start asking what other kind of beyond standard model properties would neutrinos have? And so that's why they're so interesting.
And just briefly, the standard model is the model that physicists accept to how the universe is made and all the particle zoo in it?
That's right. It's what describes the little particle zoo, but it's a model, not a theory, in the sense that we have to give it a lot of inputs in order for it to be predictive for our science. And we have to go out and measure those inputs. They're not coming from first principles. And so that's why we call it a model and why we think that there's a larger theory behind it.
Ah, very. That's a great explanation. The ice cube detector, that's in Antarctica, correct? That announced...
That's right, but I've never been to Antarctica.
I won't brag that I have, so we'll just...
It runs on its own, and then it sends the data back to us for analysis.
Well, it did not find, it announced that it did not find any sterile neutrinos. Now, what is a sterile neutrino? What were they looking for?
Okay, the sterile neutrino is a cousin that we think would exist to the existing neutrino. So theories say that there should be sterile neutrinos, and they give us a little bit of an idea of what those neutrinos should look like in our data. And so we go out and we try to look and see if we can see those features. And so it's kind of like if you were an explorer and you went out to a new world and you were looking for an animal, and you were told that animal is going to have one blue eye and one brown eye. And you go out and you look, and what we've seen in neutrino physics is flashes of blue eyes as we look around, but we've never seen the brown eye. And what IceCube did was a very thorough survey of this area and to try to understand if we ever see a brown eye in that area of parameter space. We never do. So this either means our sterile neutrino doesn't look like what we thought, our sterile neutrino knows how to hide its brown eye, or it's an anomaly that, like the little blip that was being discussed earlier, may actually go away.
With all this esoteric dark matter that we don't know what it's made out of, could this sterile neutrino be a candidate for some of the stuff?
Oh, yes. Sterile neutrinos are definitely a candidate for dark matter. The favorite candidate for dark matter comes and goes in my field, but right now sterile neutrinos are one that people are definitely considering. The sterile neutrino that we were looking for in IceCube, it has a little bit less mass than the sterile neutrino that people talk about for dark matter, but they would all be a related family.
Uh-huh. And so you're not talking about the WIMPs, you're talking about neutrinos here.
That's right. A WIMP is something different. A WIMP is actually something which people usually associate. Well, first of all, a WIMP is pretty heavy.
Yeah.
And it's also something people usually associate with supersymmetry. And the sterile neutrinos are a completely different way of asking about dark matter. You know, it's because we haven't seen the WIMPs that we were looking for, we need to start thinking out of the box on dark matter. And this is one way to do it.
All right, let's think out of the box on the phones. Our number, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Deer Park, New York. Mark, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, appreciate you guys taking the call.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So, quick question. I remember, watching documentaries in astronomy and physics about neutrinos and not really understanding it that much. But I got a quick question. Do neutrinos take up space? Like, so for instance, if you could put a million neutrinos in a jar, would you be able to put more stuff in there, or is it like light?
Hmm.
I never kind of Sorry.
Yeah. What are these?
Well, in a basic sense, the standard model is the description of the very, very small, like Janet was pointing out with neutrinos, and each one of these particles has a different m, a different mass, but this mass is not the same thing that we think of in terms of, you know, like a massive bouncer at a bar or something. The mass is sort of like a number that Mother Nature puts there for us, and so these particles are point particles to the best description that we have, and so they don't take up space per se. They have other properties, but they don't take up spatial extent. So you can put a large number of neutrinos in a jar.
So we would have a million neutrinos going right through us now, sitting here.
Probably more than that. Is
not
that right, Janet?
That.
Yeah. And
go ahead.
Yeah, and in fact, we have, as Jenna pointed out, we have a lot more neutrinos passing through our body right now, every second. We also, by some estimates, we have something like billions of particles of dark matter also coursing through our body right now. And this would be some of these WIMP hypotheses and some other related, you know, out of the box hypotheses. And so there's a lot of stuff going through us right now that we don't necessarily, you know, it's not interacting with us. Mm-hmm. So. No spatial extent in that respect.
Speaking of a lot of stuff, Dr. Beecham, what exotic particles do you think could be floating out there in the universe that maybe the LHC could find, or maybe we need a bigger machine?
Well, that's a really good question. What I think doesn't really matter. You know, Mother Nature chooses, you know, for us before we, and our job as explorers is to go and look for it. So the things that we're looking for at and we're sensitive to at the LHC are, for instance, you know, we can't actually look for dark matter particles. We can't directly detect them because, you know, they're dark and they don't interact with our standard apparatus, and so we have to detect them in indirect ways. But yeah, dark matter is something that we look for at the LHC. We're also looking for things like exotic cousins, heavy cousins of the Higgs boson. And we're also looking for things like gravitons. And this would be a hypothetical particle of gravity, which has been theorized for a very long time, but we've never seen an evidence of.
Mm-hmm. And Janet Conrad, you're working on a liquid argon neutrino experiment. How would this work differently than the other neutrino detectors?
So this is a new state-of-the-art technology, and it's 170 tons of liquid argon. Liquid argon is about very close to the same temperature as liquid nitrogen, so it's a cryogenic experiment. And the reason why you use it is because you can actually get exquisite images from a detector like this, so it is almost like you're looking at a photograph of the neutrino interaction as it occurs. It's very exciting. It is also very state-of-the-art, and so we are in the process of trying to bring up our detector now. The first big one, the really large one, to be built in the United States is Microboon, which is running at Fermilab.
Well, let's go to the phones. A lot of questions here coming. Let's go to Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Mitchell.
Hello. How are you today?
Hey there. Go ahead.
Yes, I was curious. I've heard a lot of talk about the LHC recently and other super colliders all around the world. And many scientists, such as like Stephen Hawking and others, have come out and said that it's very dangerous and you're basically playing with fire. How do we know that these are actually safe and they're not affecting our weather or our electromagnetic sphere that we have, the magnetosphere around the Earth?
Mm-hmm. James, Janet, who'd like to tackle that one?
Well, I can speak for the LHC. The notion of the LHC, we talk a lot about how we are exploring the unknown here with this highest energy ever. And that highest energy ever is something called 13 TeV, trillion electron volts. And this really is the highest energy that we've used in a collider experiment. However, this is not the highest energy by any stretch of the imagination of even things that happen nearby us on the globe. So, for instance, there are particle collisions that happen in the upper atmosphere from incoming cosmic rays that are thousands of times more energetic than our collider experiment. The whole point of our collider experiment is that you take protons and you accelerate them up to almost the speed of light to this 13 TeV, and then under very controlled conditions in a laboratory, you have a beam where you collide those like a, you know, 40 million times a second, something like that. Mm-hmm. So the energies that we're actually using for a single proton at such high energy, it may sound, you know, it is impressive in terms of laboratory and pushing into the scientific unknown, but it's kind of it's actually the kinetic energy of, you know, like a mosquito. So it's not such a big deal. Hmm. In the magnetic fields that we use in these magnets, we do have to keep our magnets in the LHC tunnel. We have to keep them at very, very cold temperatures, actually colder than outer space, so that we can bend these protons. But the magnetic fields that we're using are really, really insubstantial compared to the larger ones. So it's an extremely remote possibility that we're affecting weather patterns, and it, you know, no one's ever seen any evidence for it. So I think you're okay.
Let's go to Steve in Killingworth, Connecticut. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Got a situation for you and a question. Suppose I was going to study a bowling ball, and it was in this dark room, and the way I decided to study it was to shoot another bowling ball at it and bust it all apart. The only thing I could look at was the remnants of the pieces of this bowling ball that blew apart. Wouldn't that give me a rather strange interpretation of what the bowling ball was? And my question is, isn't there any other way to study these minute particles and waves and energy than blowing them apart?
Let me get Janet to answer that first. Janet?
I think that's a perfect analogy. That's an example that I like to use is actually that you hit an egg. So you throw a BB at an egg and you blow the egg apart. Would you then be able to reconstruct that back into what an egg actually looks like? We've had to work really hard in order to be able to understand how to go backwards and put together the picture. So there's ways that we can do this. We can hit it with a lot of different things and understand how the debris behaves. But unfortunately, when you get down to these very, very tiny scales, you really have to blow things apart in order to be able to really understand what's going on inside of them. We haven't found a way around that.
Yeah. Is it more exciting to find what you're looking for or to find something that you're not looking for?
To be honest with you, for me, I'm really excited about this ice cube result because it was not actually what we expected. And it's very hard to put this together with the other data that's out there that says that we should be seeing sterile neutrinos. So I see this as a real opportunity to go on another expedition. So I am really happy about it. I realize that it's hard to explain that to the world, but it clearly is a great thing to find the thing you were looking for. And so, you know, the folks at LHC, I can't imagine how excited they were when they saw the Higgs. Mm-hmm. It has to have been great.
This is Science Friday. Sure. Let me just interrupt rudely. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, James, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say I totally agree. And we were over the moon when we discovered the Higgs boson. And, you know, but this was the last remaining piece of the standard model to plug in, this puzzle piece. And beyond that, you know, anything we find beyond that is going to be completely revolutionary because it'll be the first evidence that we've seen of a fundamental particle outside of this wildly successful standard model. And so it's a really good example to have both of these experiments, on at the same time because we both published, you know, kind of null results in a sense at around the same time. And the message from the LHC last week was not so much that just this little diphoton bumplet faded away. It was more that we have just reported our first initial findings at this kind of, I think of it as like, you know, an alien planet, you know, 13 TeV. We don't know what we're going to find. We have, you know, probably two decades worth of research to do on this data. And we just barely got here. Mm-hmm. So it's like it's our job to, you know, report back to home base in a sense. If we, you know, go to an alien planet, we look around very instantly, see if there are any big, fuzzy, easy to spot monsters. We don't see those. And so then the next, you know, we don't disappear immediately. What we do is we spend the next, you know, decade to two decades combing through the sand, trying to find the hidden stuff that could be there. So for me, what this demonstrates is that we didn't see any easy to obvious to spot particles. So this, you know, this motivates the next 10 to 20 years of research and then possibly a larger collider in the future.
Janet, there is a group, I understand, looking for millicharged particles with lasers. Tell us what that is.
Oh, yeah, this is a very interesting piece of work, which is being done a lot out of Stanford. This group is looking for particles. So at the moment, all of the particles that we know of have integral charge. They have zero charge or one charge or maybe two or more, but they don't have fractional charge that we are able to actually see in the outside world. And so these people are looking for millicharged particles. They take little balls and they balance them on laser beams. And if you have a tiny little extra bit of electric charge on them, it would cause the balance to be off. And so they can actually search for this. So it's neat. It's tabletop physics. Literally, it's on a laser table that is addressing questions that are really high energy scale questions in physics.
Wow, we'll have to watch for that result. Thank you. That sounds like kind of fun.
It is a really neat experiment that these people are doing.
All right, we're going to follow that. Some more. Janet Conrad, professor of physics at MIT. James Beacham, postdoctoral researcher at Ohio State University, also part of the ATLAS team at CERN, joining us from Geneva. Have a great weekend. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a break and then come back and look at the life of the most famous patient in neuroscience, patient H.M., and the experiments they performed on his brain. It's quite interesting and shocking. We'll be right back with the story after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For decades, Henry Mollison was known to the world only as patient H.M., the man who could not form new memories. In 1953, in an experimental surgery aimed at curing his epilepsy, doctors removed, among other things, his hippocampus. It left him in a persistent amnesiac state. Neuroscientists conducted study after study on this human lab animal to determine the extent of the damage, and he became one of the most famous cases in the field for his contributions to our understanding of memory. Here's Mollison being interviewed by late neuroscientist Suzanne Corkin.
Do you know what you did yesterday?
No, I don't.
How about this morning?
I don't even remember that.
Can you tell me what you had for lunch today?
I don't know, tell you the truth.
Mollison died in 2008, and his brain was sliced thin and digitized by a team at UC San Diego to be further studied in depth. But soon after, journalist Luke Dietrich was examining the details of HM's life as a patient, research subject, and man, and how his story fit into the area of lobotomies and other highly experimental human brain surgeries. He shares his findings in the new book, Patient HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. He's here to talk to us today. Luke Dietrich, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And we have an excerpt of your book. An excerpt of the book is on our website at sciencefriday.com/HM. Besides the title, Memory and Madness, I'm intrigued by the family secrets in your book. It's a reference to your own family's connection to the story, right? Your grandfather was the surgeon who removed the critical parts of his brain?
That's correct. My grandfather was the surgeon who transformed Henry Mollison into patient HM.
And tell us about your grandmother here.
Right. So my grandmother, when I began working on this book, it quickly became clear that there was this entire sort of chunk of my family history that I was entirely unaware of that also had strange sort of implications for memory science. So my grandmother was mentally ill, and she was institutionalized in the 1940s. This is my grandfather's wife. And my grandfather became, in part as a result of her mental illness, he became a very sort of passionate practitioner of and advocate for psychosurgery, which is what we usually think of as the lobotomy. That is sort of a surgical treatment for mental illness, the belief that you can treat all sorts of mental illnesses by removing different parts of the brain. And he became a really sort of zealous advocate and proselytizer for psychosurgery. But this kind of, zealous passion for psychosurgery was driven in large part by a very personal and kind of secret desire to discover a fix for mental illness so that he could fix his own wife, who was mentally ill. And what I discovered over the course of my research was that it's really impossible to understand the case of patient HM without understanding this long period, this sort of, campaign of psychosurgical experimentation that my grandfather and a number of other leading neurosurgeons mm-hmm. and researchers of the day participated in. HM, even though he was not, strictly speaking, sort of a psychosurgical patient because he didn't have a psychiatric disorder, he grew out of that whole period and was in many ways a culmination of it.
Was he really a human guinea pig, the kind of surgery they did on him and other people?
Well, it's, you know, this was, these were the, it was an era when sort of the modern notions of informed consent really didn't exist. You know, I found in various archives, for example, John Fulton, who was a prominent scientist at Yale University, was encouraging a researcher to go spend time with my grandfather as my grandfather was performing a series of lobotomies in a particular asylum. And he said, Dr. Scoville, who's my grandfather, he said, Dr. Scoville has been given unlimited access to the psychiatric material of this institution, and I highly recommend you go see what he's up to. And that word, psychiatric material, I had to read it twice before I realized that they were talking about human beings. That sort of attitude, this sort of blurring of the lines between medical research and medical practice was prevalent at the time. I mean, I opened my book with a quote from another neurosurgeon slash scientist who sort of straddled this divide, a man named Paul Busey, who did a lot of work with animals, with monkeys, but then began, you know, performing lobotomies. And he said, man is certainly no poorer as an experimental animal merely because he can talk.
Wow.
That was, yeah.
That's right.
That was...
Wow, times have changed, I hope.
Yes, they have.
Tell me how... you talk about this in graphic detail in your book, and it's almost like, you know, reading science fiction about the way they're carving up people's brains who are still alive. Tell us how a lobotomy was performed in those days.
Mm. Well, there were a number. It was sort of this evolving procedure. It began. It originally was directly inspired. Again, Yale. Yale comes up often in the book because Yale was sort of ground zero for the lobotomy. The lobotomy was inspired by chimpanzee research that was done at Yale, where they lesioned the frontal lobes and then found that chimps who had their frontal lobes lesioned, when faced with difficult experiments. Or tasks afterwards, couldn't perform those tasks as well as they could have before, but they no longer got as upset when they failed to execute the task properly. They exhibited less so-called experimental neurosis. And so a Portuguese neurologist named Agas Moniz saw that work that had been done in chimpanzees and wondered whether human beings with lesioned frontal lobes would also exhibit sort of less neurosis, would be less anxious, less worried by, you know, any problems they might have. And he began performing the first lobotomies in the 1930s, late 1930s. Very quickly, it leapt the Atlantic Ocean, and a man named Walter Freeman began performing sort of a variation of Agas Moniz's lobotomy. Then people like my grandfather began refining the procedure. He developed what he considered to be a much less sort of blunting version of the lobotomy than the standard one. It was called an orbital undercutting procedure, and what he would do is he would drill two sort of silver dollar-sized holes right above the eyebrows in a person's skull, and he would actually drill those using trephines that were basically modified auto mechanic tools. He would drill these discs of bone out, sort of then lever up the frontal lobes and just sort of do some very kind of precise cuts underneath, rather than the sort of more more brutal operation, some would say, that Walter Freeman was performing at the time. Walter Freeman eventually developed what he considered to be the quickest, easiest version of the lobotomy, which was the so-called ice pick lobotomy, where he would just, you know, insert what started out as a literal ice pick, and then he sort of refined it somewhat, but right above the eyeballs, sort of tap it through the orbital bones, which are very thin, you know, insert it a certain distance into the frontal lobes, and then sort of just swish it back and forth. He considered it to be almost an outpatient procedure. He thought that he could teach any sort of reasonably competent psychiatrist could learn this procedure in an afternoon.
Wow. Just the imagery.
Right.
Did anybody actually learn anything? Did it help the patients? I mean, what was the outcome of all of this?
You know, it's a very good question, and it's a very hard question to answer. For a while, I was constantly struck by how this was not a fringe procedure. This was embraced at first, and it was, pushed not just by the doctors and the researchers themselves, but by the mass media. I mean, the New York Times was running, articles about the lobotomy and talking about how, you know, suddenly there was this, it was as easy to remove madness as it was to pluck a diseased tooth. So there was a lot of general sort of mainstream excitement about this thing. But in terms of the effects, those effects became clear over the years, and they, even though they were sort of hard to quantify, there was a famous lobotomist who, took it on his own to try to figure out what it was, you know, he was doing to these patients. And he said, you know, it's very hard to figure out sort of quantifiably what we're taking from these people that we're lobotomizing. But if I had to give it a word, I'd say soul. We're removing their souls.
Wow. And HM is sort of the central figure here. How many operations did he have?
Okay, so HM only had one operation, and his operation, even though it wasn't strictly speaking a psychosurgical procedure, mm-hmm. it originated in research that my grandfather began in asylum. So it actually was identical to a procedure that he had sort of spearheaded in the asylums first, and then decided to see whether it could be modified or adapted as a treatment for epilepsy. And so my grandfather performed one operation on him, but it was one very dramatic and from HM's perspective, catastrophic operation from sort of the world of from the scientific perspective, and illuminating and revelatory operation. He removed, as you mentioned, I mean, he levered up his frontal lobes. He used that same sort of trephine approach, levered up his frontal lobes, got sort of deeper into this region known as the medial temporal lobes, and removed most of his hippocampus, his amygdala, his uncus, his entorhinal cortex. And from that point forward, from that moment forward, HM lived the rest of his life in basically 30-second increments. The present would just sort of slide off of him constantly.
And the point was to try to cure him of epilepsy, all of this?
That was the point. I mean, that was, my grandfather hoped that this operation would alleviate his seizures. HM did suffer from, devastating epilepsy. So at the same time,
So he wasn't a threat. He wasn't, trying to harm people. He just had epilepsy, and that was the point.
He
remove
just had
all
epilepsy.
Of that stuff for just
right, but at the time nobody knew exactly what that stuff did, mm-hmm. which is both. I mean, that doesn't excuse it, because you would think then maybe it's best not to remove it. And in a sense, there was this, once again, this strange straddling of the divide between medical practice and medical research. My grandfather didn't know what these structures did. He had been performing very similar operations on, psychotic patients in the backwards of asylums, but their minds were so kind of muddied by mental illness that the actual effect of the operation was very difficult to glean. And there was a huge amount of interest in determining what these structures did at the time among the sort of broader scientific community. There was there was a real kind of drive to figure it out. And patient HM, in that case, was this extremely useful individual in the sense that he had a mind that was normal. He was more, apart from his epilepsy, he was, psychologically sound. And so it was immediately apparent what he lost, whereas it hadn't been so immediately apparent in the disturbed asylum, patients.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Luke Dietrich, author of HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. It's as chilling a story as any, going to the movies or reading a Stephen King novel would be about these patients. And so why is HM singled out and reached such fame that he did amongst everybody else? And it was kept secret. He was kept secret, was he not?
Right. Well, the results were not kept secret. Countless papers were written about him. But yes, his identity was kept secret. He was sort of this constellation of data and information floating behind this, anonymizing set of initials, HM. So his real name, Henry Mollison, wasn't revealed until the day after he died in a front page obituary in The New York Times. What was so, there were numerous things that were important about him and that made him kind of this epic, famous figure. And a lot of the revelations that came out of the study of HM came fairly early on. There's a brilliant neuropsychologist at McGill University who's still active there, as a researcher and a professor. And I don't want to get her age wrong, but she's in her 90s, mid 90s, I believe. Brenda Milner, and she had been. There were a lot of operations going on at McGill where they would remove from one hemisphere of the brain these same structures, but they wouldn't go bilaterally like my grandfather did. But they would remove, one half of the hippocampus, amygdala, uncus, entorhinal cortex. And they found in a couple of those cases that postoperatively, these patients also suffered from amnesia. And so she had a hunch that what was going on, even though she didn't have the type of neuroimaging, technology that we have today, she had this hunch, she and her and the neurosurgeon, Wilder Penfield, who was actually performing the operations, that those structures must somehow be required to create new long-term memories. But they didn't know because they couldn't see the other, the other side of the brain at that point. And so they thought the other side of the brain in those individuals must have already been damaged and compromised, which effectively made them bilateral operations. But when she heard about the amnesia, it was basically my grandfather ran into the neurosurgeon at a conference, and they got to talking, and they were talking about these somewhat similar operations they'd been performing, and my grandfather mentioned patient HM to the neurosurgeon, and then he mentioned it to Brenda Milner, and she immediately wanted to go down to Hartford, Connecticut, which is where HM lived, which is where Henry Mollison lived, in order to study him. And so she took that first trip in, I think, 1955, and then she and my grandfather collaborated on a paper about him, centered on him, that really is sort of the cornerstone for the skyscraper that is modern memory science. And it had a very simple conclusion, and that conclusion, but it was simple but also revolutionary. It was that Henry clearly could no longer create new long-term memories. They knew more or less with, more or less precision and specificity exactly what had been taken from his brain. And so those structures must be required to create new long-term memories. And that was a revelation.
Okay. We there's so much more to talk about and read about. You get the book yourself. It's Lou Dietrich's book, HM, A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets. A fascinating read, and a personal story in there too, Luke. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Speaking of books, the Sci-Fi Book Club is back in session, and we're reading Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake. And for you folks in New York, our New York City Book Club members, we're having a special in-person meeting with Margaret Atwood. Yeah, you can come and sit in a room and chat with her. She's going to join us for a live conversation at Housing Works. That's Tuesday, August 23rd. You can get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/bookclublive. Margaret Atwood will be with us Tuesday, August 23rd. Tickets at sciencefriday.com/bookclublive. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Senior producer Christopher Intagliata. Producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, Sarah Fishman, Jack Horowitz at the controls here at the studio of our production partners, the City University of New York. Come to our book club live, sciencefriday.com/bookclublive, on our website. I'm Ira Flato in New York.